familiar from the opening lines of the Gospel of John, in which Jesus is described as an embodiment of the Logos. This passage, written in the form of an antiphonal hymn, is clearly a quotation from an older work. Everything it says of Jesus, the envoy of Sophia, had already been said of the goddess herself in the Sophia literature. Philo was based in Alexandria, in Egypt, the cultural center of the ancient world, and an eclectic melting pot of different spiritual traditions. Here, taking as his mythological models the pagan figures of Osiris Dionysus and the Great Mother, this Jewish Gnostic created his own mythic figures of the Logos and Sophia. A little later, these same figures would appear as Jesus and Sophia, the central figures of the myths taught by thriving schools of Christian Gnosticism operating throughout the Mediterranean. Schools of Christian Gnosticism. By the first half of the first century, there were already three distinct schools of Christian Gnosticism, which suggests once again that in some form or other, Christianity had been in existence for some time. These schools are the Simonians, Paulists, and Ebionites. The issue which divided them was the relationship of Christianity to traditional Jewish religion. The Simonians were radical internationalists who rejected Judaism and its tribal deity Jehovah as redundant, literalist nonsense. The Paulists were also internationalists who wanted to free Christianity from close ties with Judaism, but took a more moderate view, seeing Christianity as fulfilling and therefore surpassing Judaism. The Ebionites were nationalists who saw Christianity as a specifically Jewish cult and wanted Christians to conform to traditional Jewish religious customs. These schools can be considered as different wings of early Christianity. The Simonians were the left-wing revolutionaries who wanted to overthrow Jewish literalism. The conservative Ebionites saw Christianity as a movement of reform within Judaism. The Paulists in the center considered Judaism to be superseded by Christianity and therefore obsolete. None of these Christians were practicing Christianity as we would recognize it today. Christian literalism, from which nearly all forms of modern Christianity have evolved, didn't begin to appear until the middle of the second century. Simonians. The man vilified by later Christian literalists as the father of Christian Gnosticism was an early first century Samaritan, known as Simon the Magus. Because we have inherited a version of the Jesus myth in which the hero dies in Jerusalem, we assume that Christianity was originally an exclusively Jewish cult. Actually, many early Christians, such as Simon, were Samaritans, and there is no evidence to suggest that they set their Christ myth in a Jewish setting. Today, only a small number of Samaritans survive, but at the time, they far outnumbered the Jews. Samaria had its own distinct religious traditions, also based on the books of Moses, which rivaled the Jewish temple cult based in Jerusalem. Writing in the middle of the second century, Justin Martyr, who was himself a Samaritan, tells us that Simon was regarded with great reverence by nearly all Samaritans. This is an amazing testimony to Simon's influence from a source which is nothing but hostile to him. Simon is said to have been the most outstanding disciple of John the Baptist. The story goes that when John died, Simon was in Alexandria, where he had received a Greek education. So another Samaritan Gnostic, Dositheus, became John's successor. When Simon returned home, however, he became the acknowledged master. John, Simon, and Dositheus were probably linked to the Essenes, either as envoys or founders of a breakaway school. John teaches in the wilderness, close to where the Essenes were based. Dositheus is said to have come from the same area. Essene teachings show the influence of Persian Zoroastrianism, which would explain why Simon was called Magus, a Zoroastrian term for a sage. Simon was also known as Faustus, or Honored One, and described himself as a Christ. His followers regarded him as an embodiment of the great power, the male aspect of the mystery of God. He travelled with a spiritual partner called Helen, who was seen as an embodiment of the goddess. Many important later Christian Gnostics are part of Simon's lineage, including the first century Samaritan master Menander, the 2nd century Alexandrian masters Carpocrates, Epiphanes and Basilides, the Syrian master Cerdo, who taught in Rome, and Saturninus of Antioch. The Christian literalist Irenaeus complains that from Simon a multitude of Barbaloites has arisen. These Gnostics developed myths in which the goddess, called by them Barbalo, was prominent. The Simonians were enthusiastic eclectics who sought out Gnostic wisdom wherever they could find it. The literalist Hippolytus tells us that Simon interpreted the words of Moses and the pagan poets. His followers continued this tradition of open-mindedness. Basilides even wrote a book on Hinduism. They had no time for nationalistic Jewish literalism, whose complex religious rules and regulations they regarded as unnecessary mumbo-jumbo. Faith and love were the only prerequisites to being saved through the experience of Gnosis. Simonians waged war on the Jewish literalists' anthropomorphic image of God as the jealous and despotic tribal deity Jehovah, requiring their initiates to ritually declare their rejection of this false god. These Jewish Gnostics opposed the Jewish literalists' personification of God for the same reason that pagan Gnostics mocked the personified gods of pagan literalists. For Gnostics, God is the great mystery which is the source and essence of all that is. Any idea of God is just that, an idea. Confusing the idea of God with the true ineffable nature of the mystery is idolatry. The image is mistaken for the essence. To Simonians, the literalist interpretation of the Old Testament portrays the mystery of God as a Jewish monarch, which is ridiculous nationalist nonsense. Cerdo asserts, "The God proclaimed by the law and the prophets is not the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. The God of the Old Testament is known, but the Father of Jesus Christ is the unknowable." Paulists. Of all early Christians, Paul was the most revered by later Gnostics. He was the primary inspiration for two of the most influential schools of Christian Gnosticism, set up by the early 2nd century masters Marcion and Valentinus. Christian Gnostics, calling themselves Paulicians, ran the seven churches in Greece and Asia Minor that were established by Paul, their mother church being at Corinth. The Paulicians survived until the 10th century and were the inspiration for the later Bogomils and Cathars. Marcion was originally a student of the Simonian Gnostic Cerdo, but when he set up his own highly successful school, it was Paul he placed center stage as the great messenger. Even his later literalist critics acknowledge that Marcion was a veritable sage and that his influence was considerable. Valentinus tells us he received the secret teachings of Christianity from his master Theudas, who had in turn received them from Paul. Based on these teachings, Valentinus founded his own influential school of Christian Gnosticism, which survived as a loose alliance of individual teachers until it was forcibly closed down in the 5th century by the literalist Roman Church. The number of 2nd and 3rd century Valentinians that we can still name is testimony to Valentinus's importance. Alexander, Ambrose, Axionicus, Candidus, Flora, Heraclian, Mark, Ptolemy, Secundus, Theodotus and Theotimus. Paul was such an important figure in the Christian community that at the end of the 2nd century, the newly emerging school of Christian literalism could not simply reject him as a misguided heretic, but felt compelled to reshape him into a literalist. They forged in his name the now thoroughly discredited Pastoral Letters, in which Paul is made to spout anti-Gnostic propaganda. Throughout his genuine letters, however, Paul uses characteristically Gnostic language and gives Gnostic teachings, a fact that is deliberately obscured by literalist translators. Like later Christian Gnostics, Paul addresses his teachings to two levels of Christian initiates, called psychics and pneumatics, describing the latter as having gnosis. Of himself he writes, "I may not be much of a speaker, but I have gnosis." He sees his mission as awakening in initiates an awareness of the Christ within, the one consciousness of God. By instructing all without distinction in the ways of Sophia, so as to make each one an initiated member of Christ's body. Paul tells us that when he personally experienced Christ, it was as a vision of light on the road to Damascus. Damascus was a code word used by the Essenes to refer to their base in Qumran, which suggests that Paul, like Simon, had Essene affiliations. He uses the same language as the Essenes, for example, when he describes human beings as being enslaved by the powers of fate, imagined as the elemental rulers of the cosmos, the archons of this dark cosmos from which Christ has set us free. Paul, like Simon, was an internationalist who wanted to liberate Christianity from any baggage it had inherited from Jewish literalism. He writes dismissively of the traditional Jewish law. I count it as so much dung. All I care about is knowing Christ, experiencing the power of the resurrection, sharing his sufferings, in growing conformity with his death, so that I may finally arrive at the resurrection from the dead. Again, like Simon, Paul is adamant that the true God is the ineffable oneness, not the national Jewish deity. Do you suppose God is the God of the Jews alone? Is he not the God of the Gentiles also? Certainly of the Gentiles also, if it be true that God is the one. For Paul, Jewish literalism divides Jews from Gentiles. It is a curse which could be healed by the syncretic figure of the Jewish Messiah or pagan God-man Jesus. He explains that Jesus has broken down the enmity that stood like a dividing wall between Gentiles and Jew, creating out of the two a single humanity in himself, thereby making peace. This was his purpose, to reconcile the two in the oneness of God. However, although Paul wants to dump Judaism, he doesn't completely condemn it, as Simon did. He accepts that it is appropriate for those Jews who wish to maintain their indigenous traditions, but maintains that it is irrelevant to Gentiles and Jewish initiates who wish to leave the old ways behind. For Paul, Jesus fulfills the laws and the prophets, precisely because he takes us beyond them. Of Paul's later followers, the Valentinians maintained this more liberal approach. Martian, however, amplified Paul's criticism of Judaism. He wrote a famous treatise called Contradictions, setting out all the differences between the God of the New Testament and the God of the Old Testament. As a way of distancing Jesus from the figure of the Jewish Messiah, Martianites and others with a similar perspective claimed to follow Jesus Christos, Jesus the Good, rather than Jesus Christus, Jesus the Messiah. From as early as the middle of the first century through to the fifth century, we hear of those calling themselves Christians rather than Christians. Ebionites. The other school of early first century Christian Gnosticism was the Ebionites, or Poor Ones. They were based in Jerusalem, where Paul says he visited them. Ebionites wanted Christian Gnosticism to retain its ties with traditional Jewish religion. They emphasized that Christianity was for Jews, and that if Gentiles wanted to embrace it, they would have to undergo circumcision and keep all the laws of Moses. Paul vehemently attacks Ebionite leaders, calling them evil and dogs. He complains that they proclaim a different Jesus from himself. He ridicules them for arrogantly regarding themselves as super messengers because of their Jewishness, dismissing them as axe-wielding circumcisionaries who might as well go the whole way and make eunuchs of themselves. Ebionite letters attributed to Clement of Rome retaliate with similar ferocity, attacking Paul as inspired by Satan. Paul's internationalist Christianity flourished amongst Gentiles, but was largely unacceptable to Jews. He reports that only four Jewish Christians worked with him, and that he was often attacked by Jews for preaching his heretical vision of the mystical Messiah Jesus. Ebionite Gnosticism, on the other hand, due to its ties with Judaism and insistence on circumcision, made little impact beyond the Jewish community, although it did survive for hundreds of years and influenced the creation of Islam. The real importance of the Ebionites is not who they were, but the fantasies which were later created about them. Because they were based in Jerusalem, later Christian literalists claimed that they were the original disciples of the historical Jesus. However, in the 2nd century, when the Christian literalist Melito of Sardis went to Jerusalem hoping to find the descendants of the original disciples, he found only Ebionite Gnostics, whose Christianity was inspired by heretical scriptures, such as the Gospel of the Ebionites, the Gospel of the Hebrews, the Gospel of the 12 Apostles, and the Gospel of the Nazarenes. Paul happens to mention the names of some Ebionites in his letters. He refers to a particularly conservative leader, called James, as a brother of the Lord. Later literalists took this literally and became convinced that not only was there an historical Jesus, but that Paul knew his brother. Actually, the title, Brother of the Lord, was used by Christian Gnostics to refer to each other and is not specific to James. The Gnostic Apocalypse of James categorically tells us that James was not literally Jesus' sibling. Paul also mentions a Cephas. Because the Hebrew name Cephas means the same as the Greek name Peter, literalists assume Paul to be talking about the Simon Peter of the Gospels. But actually, at the time that Paul was writing, the Gospel story as we know it had not been created. Christ was a mystical, timeless figure, not yet the hero of a historical romance set in Judea, and the character of Simon Peter had yet to be invented. Paul is definitely not writing about the Peter of the Gospels. He is extremely critical of the Cephas he mentions, to an extent that would not be credible if he were talking about the historical Jesus' right-hand man, especially when Paul had never met Jesus himself. Paul never mentions any of the Gospel events to do with Simon Peter, or the times that Jesus is portrayed as being hostile to Simon Peter, even when simply mentioning one of these criticisms would clearly clinch his argument with Cephas. Free spirits. What sort of people were the original Christians? Much of what we know of them is recorded by later Christian literalists. From their critical testimony, it seems that, apart from more conservative groups, such as the Ebionites, they were characteristically eclectic, egalitarian, rebellious free spirits with a wickedly irreverent sense of humour. Their attacks on the sacred cows of Jewish literalism are deliberately provocative. Some schools rework Jewish mythology, recasting all the goodies as baddies and the baddies as goodies. Traditional biblical villains, such as Cain, Esau, and the Sodomites, become fearless heroes for standing up to the oppressive Jehovah. The evil snake in the traditional reading of the Genesis myth becomes the serpent of light, an embodiment of Jesus, who encourages Adam and Eve to eat of the tree of Gnosis. Poking fun at sanctimonious literalists, Martian writes, "When Jesus descended into hell, the sinners listened to his words and were all saved. But the saints, believing as usual that they were being put to the test, rejected his words and were all damned." Other Christian Gnostics took a less combative approach, which Christian literalists found even more infuriating. They viewed the literalist understanding as a stage that initiates sometimes needed to pass through on the path to Gnosis, and as Gnosis itself could never be expressed in words anyway, saw no problem in simply going along with whatever literalists said. The literalist Irenaeus complains that it is impossible to argue with such people, because they keep on agreeing with him, although he is sure that in secret they believe something else entirely. When literalists asked initiates of the Massalian school of Christianity if they believed one thing or another, they would always answer, yes, whatever the question. The literalist Epiphanius records with dismay the following conversation. "Are you patriarchs? Yes. Are you prophets? Yes. Are you angels? Yes. Are you Jesus Christ? Yes." If nothing else, you have to admire their sense of fun. Eclectics. Christian Gnostics were enthusiastic eclectics. The Narcene school taught that there was one spiritual system underlying the mythology of all religions. These Christian initiates were also initiated into the pagan mysteries of the Great Mother. They praised the great pagan poet Homer as their prophet and equated their Jewish godman Jesus with the various mythical faces of the pagan godman, Osiris, Attis, Adonis, Pan, Bacchus, and so on. For them, the Son of God was many-named and known by different cultures in different ways. The Sethian school of Christianity practiced an adaptation of the pagan mysteries of Orpheus. When the Roman Emperor Hadrian visited Alexandria in the first half of the second century, he encountered Christians who practiced the local pagan mysteries of the god-man Serapis and who studied Pythagorean mathematics and astrology. When the Valentinian teacher Marcellina came to Rome, she brought with her painted icons illuminated with gold representing Jesus, Pythagoras, Plato, and Aristotle. The literalist Hippolytus wrote that whatever variations there may be between the systems of the Simonian and Valentinian Gnostics and that of Pythagoras was in name only. Alongside the Christian Gospels discovered at Nag Hammadi were found works by Plato and works attributed to the mythical ancient Egyptian sage Hermes Trismegistus. The pagan master Plotinus, who taught in Rome in the middle of the 3rd century, treats Christianity as a rival school of philosophy, which, like his own, had developed from the teachings of Plato. Much to his consternation, members of his own school were also initiates of Christian schools. Plotinus writes of some of our own friends who fell in with this doctrine before joining our circle and, strangely, still cling to it. The closeness of Christian and Platonic Gnosticism is also obvious from the fact that the influential Christian Gnostic Origen and the great pagan Gnostic Plotinus were both pupils of the Platonist Ammonius in Alexandria. Indeed, if Christian Gnosticism had triumphed instead of Christian literalism, the Christian Old Testament, as it were, would probably have been the works of Plato, instead of the largely banal Jewish texts we have actually inherited as Holy Scripture. Gnostics are eclectics because they understand different spiritual traditions as using different conceptual languages to point us beyond words altogether to the realization of Gnosis. All philosophical ideas are relatively true or false expressions of the absolute truth, which is by its nature inexpressible. If we become fixated with the words, as literalists do, we mistake the message for the meaning and end up eating the menu, not the meal. The Gospel of Philip cautions us, names are very deceptive because they turn the heart aside from the real to the unreal. Whoever hears the word God doesn't think of the reality, but of what is unreal. Likewise with words such as Father, Son, Holy Spirit, life, light, resurrection, church, and so on. Egalitarians. Following in the tradition of pagan philosophers such as Antiphon, Epicurus, Diogenes, and Zeno, Christian Gnostics were political radicals who preached liberty, equality, and fraternity centuries before the French Revolution. Epiphanes, the son of Gnostic master Carpocrates, although he died at the young age of 17, wrote an extraordinary treatise called On Justice, in which he condemned property and social authority and declared that all have divinely ordained rights, whether they be free or slaves. Where does justice lie, he asks. In a community of equals, he answers. He proposes a mystical anarchism which urges us to discover the natural goodness within ourselves and live according to our own essential nature. Being constrained by unnatural man-made laws stops us living in communion with the divine laws of life. Anticipating Proudhon's slogan, "Property is theft," he argues, when man forgot that community means equality and deformed it by laws, on that day the thief was born. Creating visions of social utopias has always been a part of the Gnostic tradition. Gnostics are idealists, both in the philosophical and political sense of the word. Pythagoreans lived in egalitarian communities in which property was held in common and women were treated as equal, which inspired the first Christian monasteries. The Stoic school of pagan Gnosticism developed the idea of the politeia of Zeus, or commonwealth of God, a community of equals living naturally in harmony with the divine order of things. Christian Gnostics from Paul onwards also talk of the commonwealth of God and the kingdom of God as an ideal state to which we should aspire. Christian Gnostics followed the dictates of their own hearts and rejected any external authority. They call themselves a generation which knows no tyranny and a kingless generation, addressing each other as brother or sister. They did not develop a fixed ecclesiastical hierarchy like the literalists, but cast lots to select who would take leadership roles, such as priest, overseer, reader, and so on. This prevented power from being consolidated in the hands of any one person, as happened later in the literalist Roman Church, with disastrous consequences. Much to the horror of misogynistic Christian literalists, Christian Gnostics dared to treat women as equal to men. Epiphanes writes, "The Father of all gave us eyes to see with, and his only law is justice, without distinction between man and woman." Pagan Pythagorean Gnostics were also famous for treating women as equals. In the Jewish Therapeutes school of Pythagoreanism, women were particularly honored for their love of Sophia, and Christian Gnostics continued this tradition. Some schools were named after women, such as Helen, Salome, Mary, Marcellina, and Martha. In fact, the pagan philosopher Celsus, writing about Christianity circa 170 CE, only knows of gospels written by women or sects named after women. The literalist Irenaeus regrets that women were particularly attracted to Gnostic Christianity and is appalled that the Gnostic sage Marcus encouraged women to become priestesses and officiate at the Eucharist celebration. The bigoted Tertullian is enraged that women Gnostics dare to teach and engage in discussion, and horrified at the idea of them baptizing and acting as bishops. Paul tells us it was the accepted practice for male Christian Gnostics to travel with a female spiritual partner, whom he calls a sister wife. Paul himself traveled with a woman called Thecla, and he mentions other women, Prissa, Junia, Julia, and Nereus's sister, who worked and traveled in missionary pairs with their husband brothers. Other man-woman Gnostic teams we know of include Simon and Helen, Dositheus and Helen, Apelles and Philomene, and Zosimos and Theosebia. The Gnostic sage Montanus, who was renowned for his following of ecstatic women, travelled with two women, Priscilla and Maximilla. Libertines. Gnostics deliberately violated social norms as a way of deconditioning themselves from their social personae, and so becoming aware of their true spiritual identity. For some, such as the Cainite school, this was done through ascetic abstinence. For others, such as the Carpocratian school, this was done through libertine indulgence. Sometimes, both of these approaches were adopted by different individuals within the same school. Carpocrates taught that our ideas of good and bad conduct are only matters of human opinion, not divine decree. He taught his students to enjoy life, including the pleasures of sex that are so often condemned by religious literalists. His son Epiphanes writes, "God created the delights of love equally for all humankind, but men have repudiated the very thing which is the source of their existence." Such Gnostics saw sexuality as a celebration of the union of God and Goddess, from which all of life springs. They are said to have sometimes practiced sacramental nudity in church and even ritual intercourse. The literalist Epiphanius describes his experience as a young man of 20, meeting two pretty young Gnostic women who invited him to one of their agapes, or love feasts, which turned out to be an orgy. With the horror characteristic of the deeply repressed, Epiphanius is outraged that these Gnostics believed that they must ceaselessly apply themselves to the mystery of sexual union. These allegations, which may well be exaggerated, have led to Gnostics being portrayed as completely immoral. Carpocrates was accused of promoting the idea that we should deliberately commit as many sins as possible. Paul complains of such a misrepresentation of Gnostic doctrine even in the first century. Probably referring to the conservative Ebionites, he writes, "Some libelously report me as saying, 'Do evil so that good may come of it.'" Actually, liberal Gnostics are teaching that moral laws are unnecessary social conventions because we are actually good by nature. Someone who, through the experience of Gnosis, has discovered their true identity can live a spontaneous and natural life motivated by the good within them. For conservative literalists, then as now, such teachings are irresponsible and depraved. Rejecting the Gnostic idea of original goodness, literalists preached the absolute opposite, the pernicious doctrine of original sin. The literalist Timothy writes with disgust about the shameless naturalness of the Christian Gnostics. They eat whenever they are hungry, they drink when they are thirsty at any hour of the day, without regard for the prescribed fasts. They spend their time doing nothing and sleeping. In summertime, when night falls, they lie down to sleep in the open air, men and women together, and they say that this is of no consequence. Summary. The original Christians were Jewish Gnostics who were part of an international Gnostic tradition flourishing across the whole of the Mediterranean. Like all Gnostics, they encoded their mystical teachings in the form of allegorical myths. Out of previous Jewish and pagan myths, they created the Christian myth cycle, of which the Jesus myth is a part. The original Christians synthesized elements from the Jewish allegorical myth of the Christ, Moses, Jesus, with pagan myths of the dying and resurrecting God-man Osiris Dionysus to create the Jesus myth. In its earliest form, found in the writings of Paul, the Jesus myth is a simple initiation allegory. Paul is not concerned with an historical man, but with the mystical Christ in you. Later, the Jesus myth was fleshed out as a more complex allegory in the form of a pseudo-history. None of the early schools of Christianity resemble the literalist Christianity with which we are familiar today. The original Christians were characteristically eclectic, egalitarian free spirits, who treated women as equals and rejected organized religion. What happened? How did a disparate group of libertine anarchists end up creating a religion that would come to dominate the world by force? How did an allegorical myth composed by imaginative mystics come to be understood as a literal account of the most important events in history? Chapter 3. Church of the Antichrist. That which is called the Christian religion existed among the ancients and never did not exist from the beginnings of the human race until Christ came in the flesh, at which time the true religion, which already existed, began to be called Christianity. Augustine, Retractions. It is a common pattern in the history of spirituality that dissident, non-conformist Gnostics find they have unwittingly inspired an authoritarian, literalist religion. Religions characteristically begin with charismatic masters who share their personal understanding of the Gnosis with small groups of spiritual enthusiasts, teaching the perennial philosophy in their own unique way. Over time, the number of students grows until there are too many for them to all have personal access to the teacher. It becomes impractical to carry on as a disparate band of anarchic mystics, and those with a more authoritarian nature start to organize things. Before you know it, a new religion has been born. But the more the student-master ratio becomes unbalanced, the more the general level of understanding diminishes. Subtle allegorical teachings become understood in superficial literal ways. The trajectory is one of inevitable degeneration from the simple but sophisticated teachings of Gnosticism to the shallow but often complex teachings of literalism. This is exactly what happened with Christianity. The literalist heresy. Once the Jesus myth had been set in an historical context, it was only a matter of time before a group of Christians began to interpret it as a record of actual events. By the middle of the second century, a literalist school of Christianity had begun to emerge in Rome, with autocrats such as Irenaeus as its spokesman. The Gnostics' understanding of the Jesus story as an initiation allegory leading to salvation through Gnosis was replaced by the literalists' idea of salvation through belief in an historical Messiah. Literalists did not claim Christian teachings to be radically different from pagan philosophy and were well aware of the similarities between the story of Jesus and the pagan myths of Osiris Dionysus, but they had one unique, eye-catching selling point. The other mystery cults had myths that may or may not have referred to actual events in the archaic past. But literalist Christians claimed that their myth of the dying and resurrecting God-man had recently been realized in real life. This is literalist Christianity's one claim to uniqueness, which was made by Augustine, the great spokesman of Christian literalism. As someone who had been a follower of both the pagan Gnostic Plotinus and the Christian Gnostic Mani before becoming a Catholic, Augustine knew there was nothing exceptional about Roman Christianity but this one incredible idea. Christ came in the flesh. Christian literalism was destined to dominate the West with an iron fist for nearly two millennia, but it began as an insignificant sect with a macabre enthusiasm for the imminent end of the world. The Gnostic myth that Jesus would appear at the culmination of time was an allegory expressing the idea that when all souls were reunited with the consciousness of God, there would be a return to the primordial state of oneness and the cosmic drama would be over. Literalists took this myth literally, developing the grotesque idea that Jesus was about to arrive to destroy the world, rescue a small group of Christian literalists, and condemn everyone else to eternal torment. Thankfully, they turned out to be wrong. However, replacing the mythical sacrificed God-man with an historical martyr led to Christian literalism becoming a sort of suicide cult, which, much to the horror of the Gnostics, encouraged its members to imitate Jesus by also seeking out a sacrificial death. In the literalist version of Christian history, the Roman authorities are pictured as singling out the Christians for terrible persecution. Actually, they were often appalled at Christian literalists' eagerness to be martyred. Literalism replaced the enlightened Gnostic sage at the center of a small group of initiates with a hierarchy of bishops at the head of an expanding evangelical cult. The whole purpose of Gnostic initiation was to bring initiates to spiritual maturity, where they would experience themselves to be completely free of any external authority and become their own Christ or King. Literalists, by contrast, wanted to enlarge their religious power base and worked hard to keep their flock securely in the fold. Despite the fact that in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus teaches everyone, when his training is complete, will reach his teacher's level, the Gnostic idea that Christianity was about oneself becoming a Christ became branded as blasphemous heresy. The role of a Gnostic master was to undermine all of an initiate's opinions and encourage them to directly confront the mystery of life. The role of the literalist bishops, on the other hand, was to tell people what to believe and to discipline those who disagreed. Free intellectual inquiry was actively discouraged, and blind belief became exalted as a spiritual virtue. As long as the Jesus story was understood as myth, Christians were at liberty to interpret it and change it as they felt appropriate. Once it became seen as a biography, the development of intolerant dogmatism was inevitable. Literalists would argue vehemently for centuries over what Jesus actually did and said, as they still do today. But as the argument is about supposed historical events, they all agree that there is only one accurate version of what really happened. And if only one version is right, that means everyone else must be wrong. Forged lineage. From the large number of Christian scriptures in existence, literalists selected four Gospels to form the canon of the New Testament. These Gospels were then declared to be the only authentic Gospels, and all of the other Christian scriptures were denounced as heretical. The four New Testament Gospels are variations on the Jesus myth, originally used by different schools of Christian Gnosticism. Putting them together created the illusion of there being four, albeit contradictory, eyewitness accounts of the same historical events. The later triumph of literalism has left us with the distorted impression that these Gospels were always the most popular Christian scriptures. But this is not true. In fact, we don't hear anything about Matthew, Mark, Luke and John until the late 2nd century. To endorse their authority, literalist bishops fabricated a lineage connecting themselves back to the fictional disciples of the Gospels. They turned Paul from the great messenger of the Christian Gnostics into a bastion of literalism by simply forging letters in his name, which make him condemn their Gnostic rivals. It's a simple trick, but it worked. It was not until the last few centuries that scholarship became sophisticated enough to see through it. Literalists also co-opted to their cause later Christian philosophers, such as the 2nd century writers Athenagoras of Athens, Theophilus of Antioch, and Minucius Felix of Africa. These writers actually promoted a philosophical Christianity based around the mythical figures of the Logos and Sophia. Not only were they not literalists, they were not even particularly interested in the figure of Jesus. Athenagoras claims to go minutely into the particulars of Christian doctrine, yet never mentions Jesus at all. Neither does Minucius Felix, even when an adversary asks him to name someone who has actually returned from the dead. Instead, he gives a list of diabolical beliefs and practices that have been wrongly attributed to Christians. These include, along with drinking the blood of sacrificed children and worshipping the genitals of priests, worshipping a man who suffered death as some criminal as well as a wretched piece of wood. As he comments, "These and similar indecencies we do not wish to hear. It is disgraceful to have to defend ourselves against such charges. When you attribute to us the worship of a criminal and his cross, you wander far from the truth." Indeed, Minucius condemns pagan literalists who choose a man for their worship, and Theophilus ridicules pagan literalists for believing that Hercules and Asclepius had actually come back from the dead. Why did literalists try and adopt to their cause writers who were so obviously promoting something quite different? Because there are no early Christian writers who defend the idea of there literally being an historical Jesus. There were no historical disciples. There were no early literalists. They all had to be invented. The earliest Christian whose writings suggest he was a literalist was Justin Martyr, circa 150. But even Justin still saw Christianity as a branch of philosophy and set up his own philosophical school in Rome. After Justin's death, his pupil Tatian abandoned his master's literalism, suggesting that it was seen as something of an innovation, and regarded the Jesus story as comparable to Greek myths, urging his pagan readers, "Compare your own stories with our narratives. Take a look at your own records and accept us merely on the grounds that we too tell stories." International Christian Gnosticism. The traditional history of Christianity is that literalism took the world by storm, while Christian Gnosticism remained a minor heretical fringe movement. This is nonsense. Christian literalism was initially a minor school of Christianity, which developed in Rome towards the end of the 2nd century. By this time, Christian Gnosticism was an international movement which had spread throughout much of the Mediterranean, flourishing in cosmopolitan cities such as Alexandria, Edessa, Antioch, Ephesus, and Rome. In Egypt, the first Christians we hear of are the Gnostics Valentinus, Basilides, Apelles, Carpocrates, and his son Epiphanes. There is no sign of any form of Christianity which resembles Roman Catholicism in Egypt until Bishop Demetrius at the end of the 3rd century. In Antioch, the Gnostics Saturninus, Cerdo, and Menander had established schools at the beginning of the 2nd century. The literalist Justin Martyr regrets that in Edessa, eastern Syria, to be a Christian means to be a follower of Marcion. The Chronicle of Edessa notes the birth of Marcion, Bardesanes, and Mani, before it mentions Roman Christianity. Even Rome itself was full of different schools of Christian Gnosticism, such as the Marcellites, Marcionites, Arcanites, Valentinians, Sethians, Barbaloites, Montanists, and Ophites. Literalists complained that in Persia all Christians were members of the Marcionite school of Christian Gnosticism. Tertullian bemoaned the fact that Marcion's followers filled the whole universe. At the beginning of the 3rd century, the Christian Gnostic sage Bardesanes initiated into his school a Syrian ruler who made Christian Gnosticism the official state cult. The forged Second Letter to Timothy has its phony literalist Paul complain, "All Asia has turned against me," which tells us that in the late second century, all Asia was dominated by Gnostic Christianity. The Epistle of Polycarp laments that the great majority of Christians embrace the idea of Jesus not existing in the flesh. The school of the 3rd century master Mani became a world religion in his own lifetime. Eventually reaching from Spain in the west to China in the east, Manichaeism flourished for 1,000 years. Mani was a great eclectic who synthesized the Gnosticism of different religious traditions in an attempt to create a truly international form of spirituality, which would embrace all humanity. His followers taught that Judaism, paganism, Christianity, and Manichaeism are one and the same doctrine. Mani himself is said to have traveled to India and believed that he was teaching the same Gnostic doctrines as the Buddha. A king of Mongolia and an emperor of China honored him as the successor of both the Buddha and the Taoist sage Laozi. The growth of Christian literalism. Over the course of the 3rd century, despite the flimsiness of its claims to be the authentic Christian lineage, literalism grew in popularity in Rome and the West, though Eastern Christianity remained overwhelmingly Gnostic. Eventually, however, it was inevitable that the simplistic certainties and offer of vicarious atonement of Christian literalism would attract more adherents than Christian Gnosticism, with its puzzling promise of gnosis through mystical transformation. As literalists grew more powerful, so did their vitriolic attacks on all other Christian schools. In response, Christian Gnostics condemned literalists for establishing an imitation church, which no longer taught the secret inner mysteries. Some Gnostics, such as the Valentinians, tacitly went along with literalism in an attempt to heal the ever-growing rift. Other Gnostics, such as Clement of Alexandria and his successor Origen, embraced the idea of an historical Jesus, but remained Platonists and continued to teach the Gnosis in their Christian school of philosophy. Christianity grew in popularity as part of a general upsurge of interest in mystery cults, such as the Mysteries of Mithras. Over a period of 350 years, Mithraism developed from a little-known Persian cult into the dominant religion of the Roman Empire, until at the end of the 2nd century CE, it was adopted by the Emperor Commodus. The Jewish Jesus cult followed in the footsteps of the Persian Mithras cult, growing in popularity from its conception at the beginning of the 1st century until 350 years later, in the middle of the 3rd century, it had large numbers of followers throughout the Roman Empire and was adopted by the Emperor Constantine. Within 50 years, Christian literalism was the party line of a totalitarian state which dictated to its citizens the one religion that they were permitted to follow. A common literalist reaction to the idea that Jesus is a mythical figure is the question, how do you explain the rise of Christianity without it being founded by an inspirational leader? Mithraism provides us with the answer. Christianity became the dominant religion in the ancient world without there being an historical Jesus, in exactly the same way that Mithraism, a few decades earlier, had become the dominant religion in the ancient world without there being an historical Mithras. Mithraism was inspired by charismatic leaders, but none of them was Mithras. In the same way, Christianity was inspired by charismatic leaders amongst the original Christians, but none of them was Jesus. In fact, the myth of Jesus was partly based on the myth of Mithras. The two stories are so similar that literalist Christians claimed that in an attempt to confuse the faithful, the devil had created the Mithras story by mimicking the life of Jesus in advance of his birth. It seems extraordinary that the Roman world embraced the mysteries of Rome's enemies, the Persians and Jews. But the vast majority of inhabitants of the empire were not Romans, of course, and had little sympathy for them. The cults of Mithras and Jesus spread so successfully precisely because they fed on conquered people's resentment of the Romans and represented a form of acceptable dissent. Roman emperors were concerned, above all, with uniting their disparate colonies. Mithraism, Christianity, and other popular mystery cults were adopted by the state, regardless of their national origins, in an attempt to bring coherence to a fragmenting empire. Christian literalism was an ideal candidate for the job. It was exactly what a Roman despot like Constantine required, a populist and authoritarian religion which had freed itself of Gnostic radicals. Although Christian literalists rejected the Gnostic inner mysteries of Christianity, they continued to portray Christianity as a mystery cult. Phrases such as, "this is known to initiates," continued to be routinely used, but they were now little more than empty words. As Christian literalism grew in power, it adopted more of the trappings of the pagan literalism it replaced. Its ritual processions were identical to those of the pagan cults. Although Jesus had specifically said, "call no man father," Christian literalists adopted the Mithraic practice of calling priests father. In imitation of the Mithraic bishops, Christian bishops wore a mithra or mitre and carried a shepherd's staff. Eventually, the Bishop of Rome took up the title of Pontifex Maximus, the ancient name for the pagan high priest, a title still held by the Pope today. The suppression of women. Literalist Christianity took as its scriptural backdrop the Jewish Old Testament with its patriarchal monotheism. It therefore vigorously suppressed the idea that there was a Christian goddess. But the people's need to relate to the divine feminine was too strong to be ignored, and the void was quickly filled. In 431 CE, a Christian council met at Ephesus, previously the chief site for the worship of the pagan goddess, and bestowed the title of the ousted goddess upon Mary, the mother of Jesus, honouring her as Queen of Heaven and Theotokos, Mother of God. Protestant literalists would later condemn this elevation of Mary, but ironically, it was actually a demotion. For the original Christians, Mary had always represented the goddess Sophia, Queen of Heaven. For the literalists, she was merely a mortal woman, special only because her son Jesus was divine. Literalists put an end to Gnostic ideas of equality between the sexes. They interpreted the Jewish Genesis myth as literal history, with terrible consequences for women. Women were no longer seen as spiritual partners with men, but the descendants of the evil Eve, because of whose sin even the Son of God had to die. Augustine wrote to a friend, "What does it matter whether it is a wife or a mother? It is Eve the temptress we must beware of in any woman." Literalists played down the importance of women in the Gospels to endorse their policy of making them second-class human beings. This reversal of attitude towards women in Christianity is symbolized perfectly by the retitling of the fourth Gospel. Known to us now as the Gospel of John, if it is to bear any name at all, it should be the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. This Gospel claims to be written by an unspecified beloved disciple. It is attributed to John solely on the basis of the literalist Irenaeus at the end of the 2nd century, claiming he had a childhood memory of being told that the Gospel was written by the disciple John. According to the Gnostics, it was written by the Gnostic master Cerinthus at the end of the 1st century. Modern research suggests that the beloved disciple he makes the narrator of the story is not John, but Mary Magdalene. Mary is clearly identified in other Gnostic sources as the beloved disciple, the disciple that Jesus loved, the companion of Jesus, and so on. As scholars have noted, the Gospel of the beloved disciple has been modified, creating obvious structural flaws in order to turn the beloved disciple Mary into the male figure of John, who was more acceptable to misogynist literalists. Attacks on Gnosticism. As their confidence grew, literalists' attacks on Gnostics became ever more virulent, creating the distorted picture of Christian Gnosticism still prevalent today. In a classic case of psychological projection, the Gnostics were misrepresented as the diabolical heretics that the literalists had actually become. Although it was literalists themselves who were preaching an exclusive religion and arrogantly condemning all other faiths as evil, they accused the Gnostics of being puffed-up sectarians and named themselves the Catholic or Universal Church. Although Gnostic philosophy teaches all is one, and literalists preach an irreconcilable war between God and the devil, literalists portrayed themselves as monotheists and the Gnostics as dualists. Although it was literalist Christianity that had begun as a suicide cult, teaching its adherents that the way to salvation was to actively seek a martyr's death, its later followers vilified the Gnostics as world haters. Christian literalists turned their caustic polemics equally against paganism, which was denounced as a barbaric cult of bloody sacrifice. This is deeply ironic, given the Christian literalist belief that God had sacrificed his only son as the sole way of getting the rest of us off the hook. When taken literally, it is difficult to imagine a more barbaric idea than that. And for all the undoubted barbarism of pagan literalists, it was Christian literalists, not the supposedly primitive heathens, who presided over the collapse of Western culture into the aptly named Dark Ages. This disastrous collapse was precipitated at the end of the 4th century when Christian literalism, now the only legal religion in the Roman Empire, launched a brutal crusade to completely eradicate its old rivals, Christian Gnosticism and ancient paganism. In an orgy of violence, armies of fanatical Christian literalists tore down the architectural wonders of the pagan world. They built infernal bonfires of books containing the spiritual wisdom and scientific knowledge of the ages. They subjected to grisly torture and a painful death philosophers, priestesses, and scientists, anyone who disagreed. They did not stop until they had cut the head off Western culture, leaving it to wander like an amnesiac in an ignorant stupor. They did not stop until they had cut the heart out of Western spirituality, bleeding it dry of its mystical vitality. The corpse of a religion which remained offered nothing but hope of a better afterlife in return for blind belief in its irrational opinions and unquestioning allegiance to power-crazed popes. This tyrannical empire of the soul extended the arm of the state right into the inner sanctum of every individual, denying the right to spiritual autonomy and compelling all to acquiesce or burn. Yet despite this ruthless persecution, Gnosticism survived. It can be suppressed, but never eradicated. It is the spontaneous expression of the natural inquisitiveness and enthusiastic exuberance of the human soul. It is the unquenchable thirst for truth and the undeniable urge to enjoy. It is the spirit of liberty, equality, love, and insight. It is the force of life. It always reasserts itself. The Gnostic heritage. Whilst by the 4th century the Roman Church in the West had condemned anything Gnostic as heresy, in the Eastern Church based in Constantinople, the original Christian spirit survived a little longer. Sages such as Basil of Caesarea, Gregory of Nyssa, Gregory of Nazianzum, Evagrius of Pontus, and Diodocus of Photis continued to teach the oral tradition of private secret teachings to those initiated into the inner mysteries of Christianity. They understood the Bible allegorically, explaining that ultimately the secrets of the scriptures can only be revealed thanks to the Gnosis. They emphasized devotion to Mary as the manifestation of Sophia and taught that the goal of Christianity was to become God. In the West, the spirit of Christian Gnosticism was smuggled back into the mainstream church via mystical writings attributed to Dionysius, a co-worker of Paul. Today, these treatises are generally thought to be the work of an unidentified 6th century monk who deliberately took the pseudonym Dionysius to claim authority for what would otherwise be condemned as heretical works. The writer is thought to have been a pupil of the pagan Gnostic Proclus, the last master of the Platonic Academy, which the Christian Emperor Justinian had forcibly closed down in 529, ending a prestigious 1,000-year history. However, in the light of our thesis that the Gnostics were the first Christians, it is possible that this view will come to be seen as mistaken, and that these texts are at least based on the works of a first century Gnostic master, as they claim to be. Dionysius is unconcerned with an historical Jesus. His Jesus is a symbolic representation of the Logos. According to Dionysius, there are two Christian Gospels, the familiar teachings of the Church, and a secret Gospel, which is symbolic and presupposes initiation, and must never be divulged to the uninitiated. He eulogizes the wonders of the divine enlightenment, into which we have been initiated by the secret tradition of our inspired teachers. The narratives and symbols of Christianity have one meaning to the uninitiated, and another to the initiated. Don't suppose that the outward form of these contrived symbols exists for its own sake. It is a protective clothing which prevents the common multitude from understanding the ineffable and invisible. Only real lovers of holiness know how to stop the workings of the childish imagination regarding the sacred symbols. They alone have the simplicity of mind and the receptive power of contemplation to cross over to the simple, marvelous, transcendent truth the symbols represent. These writings were extremely influential. No other works were so frequently translated or had so many commentaries written on them, apart from the Bible and the Consolations of Philosophy by Boethius, which was another text through which the spirit of Gnosticism survived in the dark ages of literalism. Condemned for heresy by the Christian emperor Theodoric, Boethius describes languishing in prison, where he is visited by Sophia herself, who instructs him in philosophy. Despite his vision of the goddess and never mentioning Jesus once, due to the immense popularity of his writings, Boethius was later claimed by Christian literalists as one of their own. As for the man himself, Theodoric had him tortured and then bludgeoned to death for heresy. Despite the literalist church's unrelenting attempts at suppression, some heretical schools of Christian Gnosticism continued to teach. Paulicians survived into the 10th century, Manichaeans into the 13th, and Simonians into the 14th. In the Balkans, from the 10th to 15th centuries, the Paulicians flourished as Bogomils, meaning friends of God, the traditional name for Gnostics first used by the Pythagoreans. The Bogomils even had their own Gnostic Pope. At the Anti-Bogomil Council of 1211, they were accused of performing unholy mysteries like the Hellenic pagan rites. One of their literalist opponents writes with disgust, "They denounce wealth, they have a horror of the Tsar, they ridicule their superiors, condemn the nobles, and forbid all slaves to obey their masters." In the 12th century, the Bogomils developed into the Cathars, or purified ones. Catharism was for many years the prevalent form of Christianity in large areas of France, Spain, and Italy. The Cathars called themselves the Friends of God and condemned the literalist church as the Church of the Antichrist.